Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the pieces of the war for the free world for quite some time that has warranted close attention and careful analysis is, of course, Russia, previously doing business as the Soviet Union. A man who has studied it closely, written extensively, and been extraordinarily thoughtful in his analyses and commentaries on same is our first guest. He is Dr. Stephen Blank. He is these days a senior fellow for Russia at the American Foreign Policy Council. But for some 26 years, he has served as a professor of national security studies at the U.S. Army War College. He has authored a simply mind-boggling number of monographs, scholarly articles, and books, some 900 of them all in. And he is always a welcome guest here. Sir, so good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me again, Frank.
Well, I think that I have to go to the topic a du jour with you, Steve, if I could, and that is what are you making of the controversy concerning what President Trump may or may not have said to the Russians that could, according to some, have resulted in them learning about not just some sensitive information perhaps provided to us by Israeli intelligence sources, but also perhaps in the process compromising such sources and methods?
Well, first of all, Trump has admitted that he did it, and he claims that he has an absolute right to do so. And under the law, the president can declassify anything he likes. But as you well know, because you served in the Reagan administration, you have to declassify it before you reveal it. And I doubt that Trump did that. As a matter of fact, his NSC advisor actually said he had no idea where the information was coming from. But that doesn't excuse the breach of security. I think it's unconscionable. And I think it's something that, you know, might even justify an impeachment investigation, sad to say, because it certainly is reckless endangerment of people's lives. And even though the president has the right to declassify things, I don't think he declassified it. I just think he blurted it out. And it shows, again, that he's just psychologically not fit for the job, and that's sad to say. But, I mean, there's just so much evidence for this that it's obvious to anybody.
I know you've had concerns about him on several accounts for some time. Let me pursue that in the next segment a bit with Diana West. And I want to turn, if I may, with you to something else that I know is very much on your mind with respect to the Russian portfolio that also warrants close attention, as I say. The Arctic. Stephen Blank, what are the Russians doing in the Arctic, and what are its implications for our equities and interests in that very important part of the world?
Basically, there are two things they are trying to do. One is to take advantage of climate change, which is now making the Arctic much more navigable. And what the Russians want to do is claim a huge amount of territory off their continental shelf as theirs, beyond what the UN Commission on the Law of the Sea grants littoral states, so that they can monopolize the Northern Sea route trade and to develop what are believed to be enormous energy and mineral deposits in the Arctic Ocean. Unfortunately, the price of energy and the sanctions preclude them from getting very far in this because energy costs are so prices are so low that to develop the Arctic makes no sense, the cost being so high. And sanctions make it difficult for them to get investment in the technology they need. The second thing they're doing, I think, is much more dangerous. They are militarizing the Arctic. They believe that there is some sort of NATO military threat of missiles or aerospace attack coming from the United States. Now, as we all know, for years, both the United States and the Soviet Union, and now Russia, have had their submarine-launched ballistic missiles based in areas where they could launch over the Arctic because of the polar route. This is the shortest direct route between Russia and the U.S. But apart from that, there has been no military confrontation in the Arctic, and nobody in NATO has even thought about any kind of military confrontation. But Russia insists on building up a military, and just yesterday was revealed they're building what appear to be nuclear weapon sites in the Arctic. It's absolutely crazy, given Russia's real capabilities and whatever real threats Russia might actually be facing, to imagine that there's some sort of strange-lovian threat out there to the Arctic and to these energy sources. But this is now a driving factor in Russian military policy.
We are hearing about NATO exercises, I think, under the heading Arctic Challenge, which certainly seems to be apt, given what you've just described. Are you anticipating, while there's not the kind of buildup or power projection by the Europeans or the NATO alliance or the Americans acting unilaterally, for that matter, in the Arctic, that we may see a real contest shape up there that that could get ugly?
Well, there is certainly that kind of possibility. But historically, the Arctic has never been a primary theater of confrontation. It has always been secondary. For example, in World War II, the Arctic became important because the Allies used it to convoy supplies through lend-lease supplies to Russia. And there was a lot of naval fighting up in the Arctic Ocean between German subs and Allied convoys. So I don't see the Arctic as the primary theater where a confrontation might take place. But the point is that it becomes militarily important in the event of confrontation elsewhere, because Russian subs will try to go through the Arctic Ocean into the North Sea and then into the North Atlantic, and because also they have nuclear weapons based in Murmansk. And you can't be too complacent about how the Russians are thinking about using their nuclear weapons these days.
No, that's exactly right. As you've pointed out, this is becoming not only something they've got enhanced capabilities to do, but doctrinally they seem to be adopting an ever more aggressive posture in that regard. Stephen Blank, let me ask you about a related issue. You have written at Newsweek recently, speaking of NATO, that the upcoming NATO summit must be used as an opportunity to have the alliance really recalibrate on the nature of the challenge that they're now facing from Russia. You've gone so far as to describe it as Russia being at war with Europe. Tell us more about that.
Well, if you read Russian military doctrine and statements, going back to 2005, if not earlier, their security policy starts from the presupposition of threat, and in 2004 and 5, they were making statements to senior officials, which have been published, so they're out there if you care to look for them, where they say that they're at war. I mean, this will come as a shock to everybody in the West, because there is no war with Russia, but from the Russian point of view, they're at war with Europe. It's a political warfare. It's not guns. It's cyber. It's diplomacy, democracy promotion, threats, etc. Since then, they have resolved to build up their capabilities to subvert, penetrate, and deter European and American capabilities from threatening them. And we now see a formidable array of both military and non-military capabilities. As far as actual war, just look at the information warfare. Again, using the term the way they do, to embrace the totality of attacks on information networks, on media, and so on. They interfered in the American election. They interfered in the Dutch elections. They interfered in the Austrian elections. They interfered in the German elections, and most prominently in the recent French presidential elections. This is clearly, being directed from the center. It's not happenstance that it's happening. These things are taking place.
Yeah. Do you see in the various instances you've just described evidence that they're actually having an impact? This is much debated in the United States, of course, but has it made a difference, the fact that they're engaging in these influence operations in these other countries?
Well, it makes a difference in two respects. In Europe, they have failed to achieve their goals. Their candidates have lost across the board: Holland, Austria, France. Nonetheless, the purpose of this kind of warfare is also to unnerve the target state. So there's a perpetual war of nerves going on. So while they have lost, they have not ceased. And they are continuing to do this now in the Czech Republic, which is about to have elections, apparently. So this is a permanent, ongoing condition we have to get used to. Now, in the United States, You can't say that Trump won because the Russians helped him, although it's clear that they were trying to do that. But what has happened as a result of Trump's own misadventures is that American politics are in total chaos and the standing of the U.S. has been diminished. And those are victories for Putin.
This is another form of warfare for sure that warrants our close attention. Thanks for yours, Dr. Stephen Blank, to it and for sharing your insights with us as you have been generously doing in the past. We look forward to further conversations with you. Dinah West is up next. We'll talk about political warfare straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined, as we have the high privilege of being each week about this time, by Dinah West, a longtime nationally syndicated columnist. You can find her work these days at a terrific blog, DinahWest.net. She is also the author of two best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. Dinah, it's good to have you. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Well, much to discuss. You have been, of course, a longtime supporter of President Trump, and I think it's fair to say, by just about any measure, he's having a rough patch of it at the moment. I would like to get your thoughts. Talked a little bit about this with Dr. Stephen Blank in the previous segment. On the leaks of classified information, some of them emanating from people who are deeply hostile to this president, some, it seems, being reported by them about leaks that he himself is accused of making, including to the Russians. Dinah West, please, tell us what is going on here. What should we make of it?
Well, leaking and leakology is a
leakology. I love
leakology. I actually once did a story years ago about leakology, and what I was going to say is that leaking is Washington's weapon of choice, and this kind of warfare has been waged for decades, if not longer. What we're seeing with the Trump administration and the media approach to this leak warfare is red alert DEFCON attacks and machinations designed to destabilize Donald Trump, I think, even more so than his administration, which of course is the source of many of these leaks. We've got leaks. We've got a Trojan horse White House, and we have an unlikely leader of this White House, an unlikely leader of this country, and this is a very destabilizing moment for him. And it is my hope that he sees this and understands that he has problems within just as much as problems without.
Dinah West is our guest. We are discussing the ongoing and it seems increasingly intensifying political warfare against President Trump. And Dinah West, as you say, some of it does seem to be emanating from within his own administration. You called my attention to something called Axios the other day, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about it and what it suggests about some of the thinking and some of the behavior of people who are supposedly serving this president.
Yes, well, Axios, just very briefly, is just the latest left-wing news site. It was created by Politico's co-founders, and it was richly funded by any manner of left-wing activist millionaires, the people behind Huffington Post and other sites.
But also the Koch brothers, apparently, are behind this. What do we make of that?
Well, that is the add-on. There's a lot of corporate support here, and yes, it when it comes into your inbox, if you subscribe for the free morning briefing, you too can see it is Axios presented by Koch Industries. Which, what does that tell us? Well, it just tells us that this is essentially a spectrum of enemies of everything that candidate Trump won his presidency on, the entire agenda.
It is the swamp, in other words.
It is the swamp. It is the weaponized, activated swamp. And when you see the kinds of leaking that are going into the... I mean, leaking is also... I mean, journalism cannot exist without leaking. So in the sense that somebody has information and they pass it along to a journalist, there are all gradations of this. Some of it is illegal, and you know, we can parse it. But in terms of what we're looking at with a site that's very far left and very anti-Trump, getting the kind of information they're getting from inside the White House, this is where we're coming to this much more serious problem for Donald Trump, which is his own staff that he hired. He did not hire the people that support his agenda, you know, with a couple of notable exceptions. He did not hire the people who wanted to help him turn things around, revolutionize Washington, drain the swamp. He did not hire them. And this is, you know, does he understand that? Does he see that? Does he know that there are these people out there? These are questions I do not have a clue to.
Yeah. You know, it's so troubling because what you're talking about, of course, is not only the holdovers from the previous administration who are populating much of his administration, but the people that he has, in some cases, inexplicably hired to serve him and who evidently, according to the Washington Free Beacon today, don't much like him, for one thing. And in this Axios piece that you sent around, Diana West, through your blog, dianawest.net, there's talk about a wall that has been created, particularly in the national security space, to essentially insulate the people, the adults, I guess is the way one might hear it, who are running American national security policy from this interloper president. And I mean, you call it a coup in your blog, and I'd like you to expand on that because it is profoundly troubling.
It is, and I would suggest that they consider themselves to be the adults. And what that translates to me is that they have a different agenda, that they come in as, quote, professionals, quote, experts. And so everything that Donald Trump campaigned on that made contact with the people and came in with this mandate of winning 31 states of the union is what they consider to be something that needs to be walled off, isolated, destroyed, so that the professionals can continue their essentially
preserve the swamp.
Preserve the swamp. Now, when we look at, for example, combining it with the Russia story of the week, which is the Russia supposed leak to the Russian officials by Donald Trump coming out of a meeting, a private meeting, a very small number of people who went to that meeting, the Washington Post story that broke this mentions such a swamp creature, in my view. The lone name that is actually used as opposed to the anonymous sources, and this would be Thomas P. Bossert, who is the assistant to the president for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism, formerly an advisor to President Bush 43, and formerly of the very internationalist, globalist Atlantic Council. It was Bossert who called, according to the Post, it was Bossert who called the directors of the CIA and the NSA essentially to tell on what he thought was going on with Donald Trump and the Russian ambassador and foreign minister. I don't know if he was literally in the room and heard it himself, or if this was part of a information spread, a way to get it out into further reaches of the swamp at NSA and CIA, and then we see it in the Washington Post.
The so-called deep state. Mm-hmm.
The so-called deep state. So this is the kind of chain we actually can see in plain sight in the Washington Post that Donald Trump needs to examine, and he needs to clean house. He needs to see who is on his side and see who is not. I would consider it's imposing expert in Russian intelligence what he thought Donald Trump should do at this point. And from his experience, he said, I think that he should polygraph the people who are at that meeting and figure out who said what to whom. And this sounds like a very extreme measure, and yet what we're looking at in terms of this idea of it being a coup from within, a means of neutralizing anything that Donald Trump will do. And also, think of it, this is a human being we're talking about. This must be unbelievably destabilizing to his own confidence. I mean, he's done this tremendous thing. He comes in this historic moment, and yet everything under him is collapsing. And everyone around him is trying to take him down. So it's a very parlous state.
It is a parlous state. I pray that he will be bolstered in trying to do the sorts of things that he campaigned to do. We'll be watching that closely, of course, in the upcoming first foreign trip. And Diana West, we look forward to talking with you about that and much, much more next week. In the meantime, folks, check out Diana's incredibly important writings at dianawest.net. Next up, Dr. Harold Rode will join us right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Dr. Harold Rode. We've caught up with him at the airport, Ben Gurion Airport in Israel. There's a little background noise as a result, but it's always worth the difficulties we have in finding him sometimes in the far-flung reaches of the world to be able to pick his brains. He's got a lot of them, as it happens, specifically informed and knowledgeable about the matters that are on many of our minds, especially as the president heads off to the Middle East next week. Namely, what's going on there? And in particular, the country that he met with the president of yesterday, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, namely Turkey. Harold Rode, it's good to catch up with you. Thank you for finding a few minutes for us on what I know is a busy day.
Thank you, Frank. Wonderful hearing your voice.
Harold, so give us a quick readout as best you can on how this meeting between Donald Trump and Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey went. It certainly seemed as though, you know, it was a moment of bonhomie, as they say in France, at least in the public appearances in the press conference and all that. But what's actually going on there? And should there be that kind of friendliness between our two leaders?
Well, again, I wasn't at the meeting and I wasn't privy to what went on, but I can tell you that there's some serious problems here. Yes, it's true that we have a marvelous, longstanding relationship with Turkey. Turkey was a trusted NATO ally, as President Trump said yesterday in the news conference, that the Turks were with us in Korea. They were excellent fighters. And when Turkey was a secular republic, there's no doubt that it was on our side, but we're not there anymore. Erdogan is a fundamentalist. And if, obviously, President Trump wants to defeat ISIS. And the truth is that Erdogan and his people looked the other way as the ISIS people were going across the border into Syria and into Iraq before.
Is that really, Harold, the extent of it, or was there more of an overt support for the Islamic State, given, if not an identical approach, similar aspirations for the reestablishment of a caliphate?
Absolutely, Frank. It's very simple. Erdogan's goals and those of ISIS are, in the end, the same, and they are establishing that the world must be governed by Islam. It must be ruled by a caliph, which is a Muslim ruler, which comes in place of their prophet Muhammad, and must be under the Sharia. They may not agree on the details of it.
Like who should be the caliph, for example.
Yeah, exactly. It's like my way or the highway, I guess. Something to that. That's
but again, Harold, this raises the point that though there's much talk at the moment about differences between the two governments over which elements within Syria to support, specifically the Kurds, the larger question, it seems to me, is going largely ignored within our councils of government. Am I missing something, do you think?
President Trump and his closest trusted advisors are from New York, and the world is run very differently there. It's a small group of people that make decisions, and the people below them are empowered to implement them. And if they don't like it, they can leave. They can fire them. That's not what Washington is all about. It's an entrenched bureaucracy that doesn't necessarily like what a new president wants, and this particular president for sure. And the result is they do all sorts of things to both co-opt and undermine him. And that, to me, is what is happening in Washington right now. If Erdogan is a friend, I don't think we need a lot of enemies.
Yeah, no kidding. And Harold, in that regard, let me ask you about one particular piece of this that is very ominous as far as I'm concerned, and that is in both supporting and, it seems, building up the Muslim Brotherhood internationally. They seem now to be the locus of the Brotherhood, having largely been expelled from Egypt, where their headquarters has long been, as you know, but also to be supporting Muslim Brotherhood front organizations and influence operations in this country. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I absolutely believe this is the case. Erdogan is from the very beginning, and that is long before he was prime minister and long before he was the mayor before that in Istanbul in Turkey. He was a very active member of the Muslim Brotherhood. And their goal, it's a little different from ISIS, but their long-term goal is exactly the same as ISIS, of the government of Saudi Arabia, and a lot of our other allies. Yes, we may have, shall we say, some tactical interests in common from time to time, but our strategic interests and theirs are completely different.
Yeah. Harold, you speak of Saudi Arabia. This is, of course, the first stop in the president's trip next week. The Saudis are reportedly going to be bringing in other leaders from the region. Given what you've just said, that there really is fundamentally a divergence between their long-term interests and ours, what do you expect to come out of that meeting? There's talk about a sort of NATO in the Middle East and more broadly an intensification of our alliance ties to these guys. Is that advisable or is it even practicable?
There may be some tactical things, again, that we have in common, but the long-term strategic interests are completely different. These leaders, Qatar, for example, has an American base there, and at the same time, it is a huge supporter of Islamic fundamentalism against the United States. The same is true with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the country that, in fact, has been the strongest funder of Islamic radicalism. It started basically big time in 1979. They set up the precursors of ISIS and Al-Qaeda and all that, which have now come back to haunt them. I go to the Saudi flag. Look at it. It's a green flag, and it's written on it, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger. The point of it being is we conquer by the sword. And again, it all goes back to you can call it whatever you want. It's one world ruled by Islam. Frank, you and I and everybody else in the world are eventually going to convert to Islam. And
or at the very least be enslaved by it, yeah, or dead,
okay, but wait a minute.
As the case may be.
Why is it that when people criticize Islam in any way, the world goes ballistic? But when Muslims criticize Christianity and discriminate against Christians and kill Christians in the Middle East, we all look the other way. Something is wrong with these pictures.
Yeah. Well, and the worst of it is, from my point of view, Harold Rode, that, as you know so well, that simply is interpreted by the perpetrators of this kind of practice of jihad of various kinds, violent, stealthy, civilizational jihad, whatever you want to call it, that they're winning, and therefore they should be redoubling their efforts, not considering this thing futile and backing away from it. And Harold, just to drill down on this one last question, as you look at this trip with the president, there's also concern that in the course of it, he is going to build on what seems to be an intensifying effort. Broker some kind of peace between Israel and the Palestinians on terms that almost certainly would be pretty unfavorable to Israel. This seems like a rather dramatic departure from his previous positions during the campaign. What's going on there, do you think? What do the Israelis expect?
I can only say that the Islamic definition of peace means I make the rules. That is, the Muslims make the rules, and the rest of us must submit. That is, so when Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, when he talked about we teach our children peace, he's right. Peace the Islamic way, peace his way. We will all be subservient to the Muslims. Whatever comes out of this, I'm a historian. What I believe is that they can try their best. But eventually this, I believe, will explode. There is no way that Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, same person with two names, there's no way that he can sign any type of peace agreement as we know it. Peace means bygones be bygones. You put the past behind us. I hated you, you hated me, but we're now allies and we work together. The past is over. That
doesn't exist in the Middle East.
Right. As you pointed out on this program many times, the past is never over. Harold, this is most important. We'll look forward to hearing your postmortem on what has happened this week, to the week ahead, the president's trip. We'll be back to you very soon. In the meantime, safe travels there in Israel, and thank you for your time today. Next up, we'll talk with Daniel Horowitz about some of these same issues and more. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, I'm pleased to say, joined by Daniel Horowitz, a relatively young man whose contributions to the thinking of our time about international and national political affairs is simply unsurpassed. He does it these days as the senior editor at Conservative Review, where he authors a wonderful column called The Conservative Consciousness with Daniel Horowitz. I'm particularly interested in picking his brains based on some of his recent writing at Conservative Review about Donald Trump and his evolving, shall we say, views and policy pronouncements concerning the Middle East and what I think of as Sharia supremacism. Daniel Horowitz, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you.
Great to be with you on another dull week in Washington.
Just another day at the office. That's right. Let me ask you, Daniel, of course, we are talking in the aftermath of the visit by Recep Tayyip Erdogan in the Oval Office with the president yesterday. You have called to mind as kind of a backdrop for those conversations what has been going on at the hands of the Turks in the United States. That is kind of, in a way, symbolized by, in a rather ominous sense of the word, this enormous mosque that was built reportedly with $100 million of Turkish government money in Lanham, Maryland, not far from, I believe, where you live. Tell us about that and what we should be thinking it portends for this relationship with the Turks under Erdogan.
Sure. I mean, this was really a big story that in any other week would have been a big deal, but of course was overshadowed by all the, you know, supposed scandals and allegations with Comey and the Russian intelligence leak and everything. But it's a pretty big deal, I would say, hypothetically, were the president to invite the mullahs of Iran over to meet in the White House and not, you know, give them a talking to, but instead put out on Twitter, it was an honor to meet with you. And that's really what he did with Erdogan. And the reason why I use the Iranian analogy is because in many respects, Erdogan is the Sunni version of the mullahs. I mean, they are the Sunni, the Turkish government is now the leader of the Sunni insurgency in this world, the Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas. It all gets back to that nexus. And again, you know, when we talk about national security, it starts with homeland security. Obviously, any foreign intervention militarily, diplomatically, that we're going to engage in is ultimately to secure our homeland. And our problem with homeland security starts with what goes on in our own country, with the radicalization of, you know, this growing wave of immigration we've had from the Middle East. And it starts with the Muslim Brotherhood mosque. And as you mentioned, the Turkish government, Erdogan, has funded the largest mosque just outside of the nation's capital, the largest mosque in North America. And again, he's not doing it to promote freedom. Now, keep in mind, look at the irony here. While this is going on, a bunch of anti-Erdogan protesters gathered outside the Turkish embassy. They were beaten by Erdogan's bodyguards on America's soil. I mean, if that's not symbolic of the problem of what's going on in Turkey itself, you know, I just want to call attention to your listeners. Representative Dave Brad, a great patriot, has a bill, H.R. 5824, that speaks exactly to this. It would prohibit any foreign national of a country that limits the free exercise of religion in that country from making any expenditure in the U.S. promoting a religion. And I would have loved for Trump to have messaged that, to convey that message to Erdogan. Somehow, I doubt that was the subject of the discussion.
Well, again, President Trump could not have been more clear when, as a candidate, he was talking about
this problem of Sharia, of the anti-constitutional nature of it. Dave Bratt seems to me to be right on point, but what do we make of the seeming disconnect between what the president said as a candidate and what seems to be going out? Witness this this conversation with Erdogan yesterday and presumably with the Saudis next week.
I mean, that's the problem. You can't look at anything in a vacuum. You know, as conservatives, you always got to look at the full picture, look at the before and after, look at the context. And there's a train of observations that are very disturbing here. As you mentioned, his first foreign policy trip as president is to Riyadh. I mean, that's not a coincidence. Obviously, very connected. I mean, the global warming of geopolitical foreign affairs is the peace process, the obsession with the PLO and the Oslo nonsense. I mean, this is what has sunk the last three administrations. And you would think that any administration that's committed to what Trump actually articulated in that August 15th speech, and he made a September 7th speech on foreign policy, very similarly saying you have to identify the nature of the enemy. Look, I mean, that is the armpit of the enemy. That is the impetus for global jihad. So when you start saying, well, I'm going to strike a deal, I'm going to forge a deal with the PLO and create a Palestinian state and get sucked into the same Clinton era Bush and Obama era Oslo Accords, that tells me you're following in the footsteps of your predecessors in terms of willful blindness. If you don't get the PLO and who Abbas is, that means you don't get Hamas, you don't get the Muslim Brotherhood, and you don't get the problems with Erdogan. And a lot of this, I'm sad to say, you know, he was a patriot, he served his country, but General McMaster, who's the head of the National Security Council, a lot of this is really coming from him. And it all started from those original comments when he refused to even say radical Islamic terrorism. So everything flows from there. If you don't get the Islamic threat, you're not going to understand the problems with getting involved in Islamic civil wars. Hence, he wants to put 150,000 troops on the ground in Syria. He wants to increase our presence in Afghanistan without any plan exactly what our strategic interests are. What's the end game? What are we doing there? I mean, it all kind of ties together.
Daniel, you've also been closely following, I know, the evolving Trump position on Israel. Quite apart from the peace process, there are some controversies now surrounding, this issue of was an important Israeli intelligence source compromised by the president's comments to his Russian visitors last week? And for that matter, what is one to make of what seems to be some rather peculiar repositioning on the question of whose Western wall is that anyway? And when he visits, will he be doing it with Israelis or otherwise? I mean, try to walk us through this quickly, if you would.
Well, I mean, this is going to be a Waterloo for conservatives. I mean, are we ideologically consistent? Are we intellectually honest? This was the very last high profile fight with the Obama administration that conservatives had in January, when John Kerry, refused to recognize Israel's sovereignty over Jerusalem, even over the Western Wall. And, you know, the entire right of center part of the country was in uproar. How dare you tell Jews where they could live at a time when there's so many problems with Islamic terror? You know, you're making an enemy of Israel. And, you know, here comes a new administration just a few months in, almost Orwellian, and is adopting some of the same rhetoric. When the employees of the East Jerusalem consulate essentially told Netanyahu's government that, hey, you know, we're not going to have you join Trump and visiting the Western Wall. This is not part of Israel. It's disputed territory. Everyone said, well, you know, they're just some rogue Obama holdovers. But then in the ensuing 24 hours, both McMaster and the press secretary, Sean Spicer, refused, when given the opportunity, to say affirmatively and definitively that it belongs to Israel. I mean, that's a very big problem. I mean, you want to talk about the swamp mentality, the Palestinian peace process is the epitome of that.
The epicenter,
it's very disturbing, and I think conservatives really need to raise their voice and say we need a full course correction in terms of the administration's policy on Israel.
Yeah, well, again, this is what was promised by the previous candidate, Trump, and what I think you're absolutely right, as in so many areas with respect to these foreign policy choices, needs to be urgently revisited. You raise your voice brilliantly. with every day, it seems, at Conservative Review. Daniel Horowitz, thank you for doing it with us from time to time, too. We'll look forward to continuing the conversation soon. We'll talk next with Doris Liu about a new film about the Confucius Institutes right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Doris Liu for the first time, I believe. She is an independent documentary filmmaker based in Canada. Previously worked as an award-winning journalist there with independent television stations. She is a first-generation Chinese-Canadian and has developed, I believe, a most important film that I had the privilege of seeing the other day in Washington, D.C. It is entitled In the Name of Confucius. And I'm very anxious to have her tell the story about the film and, more to the point, the business now being done by the government of China in the name of Confucius, specifically its Confucius Institutes and classrooms across this country and Canada. Doris Liu, welcome. It's so good to have you with us, and congratulations on your new film, In the Name of Confucius.
Thank you, Frank, and thanks for inviting me to your program.
We're delighted. Tell us a little bit about the film and how you came to make it.
I started to pay attention to the issue of Confucius Institutes in 2013 when I read a report about a former Confucius Institute instructor defected to the institute and stayed in Canada as a refugee, and she later filed a human rights complaint to the Ontario Human Rights Tribunal about the discriminatory hiring policies practiced by the Confucius Institute, which is discriminate to her belief in Falun Gong. And due to her legal complaint, one of Canada's top 10 universities closed its Confucius Institute. That caught my attention.
As you delve into this, Doris, what did you find behind these controversies about what role the government of China is playing in promoting these entities and what kind of effect they are having in Western societies in particular like ours?
Yes. As my research going on, and I found basically the Confucius Institutes are actually controlled and run by the Chinese government, and namely Chinese Communist Party, right?
Now, there's nominally some sort of private business concern that that runs these things, but you're saying it's just basically a front organization for the government and party?
Yes. Literally, each Confucius Institute is formed by a foreign educational institution, usually a university or school board, and a Chinese university or college. And both institutions is overseen by a governmental, Chinese governmental body called Hanban. And that Hanban is under Ministry of Education of PRC. And even though there's an equal say from the Western, we call it host institution, of how they run Confucius Institutes in terms of daily operation. But eventually, the partnership is overseen by Hanban, and Hanban is led by a council. And those members are either vice minister or high-ranking official of the Chinese government and the Chinese Communist Party.
So, Doris, when you look at this, it's pretty clear that the Chinese are using these vehicles to penetrate Western academic institutions, among other things. Rochelle Peterson at the National Association of Scholars, as you know, has recently written a very important paper. We had her on the program recently entitled Outsourced to China: Confucius Institutes and Soft Power in American Higher Education. Talk a little bit about what your research for your film In the Name of Confucius showed you was the true purpose of these organizations now burrowed into many of our leading academic institutions.
film, it parallels in many ways to Rochelle Peterson's report, Our Source to China. For me, I found the Confucius Institute's a secret deal between Chinese government and the Western universities. Usually the agreement or contract are not open to public scrutiny, as many critics found. And the Confucius Institute seems to have a very obvious intention to get Chinese government a hand into the Western
university. Yeah, and when you talk about the hand in, you're talking basically about being able to exercise influence. That influence or soft power, if you will, is being manifested in a couple of ways, as I understand it. For example, though you described a sort of equal partnership, in fact, really dictating what is being taught to their students and the kinds of party line, if you will, out of the Chinese Communist Party, quite literally, that is being promoted in the way of history or other kinds of instructions, even language instruction, I guess. Is that a fair characterization of what's happening here?
I believe so, because my main character in my film, Sonia Zhao, the former CIA instructor, she told me she had training before she was sent to Canada by the Chinese government. In the training, the instructor told those to be teachers what topics they should avoid to talk. For example, Tibet or Taiwan independence or even Chinese human rights.
Yeah. And Falun Gong, as you mentioned, this religious practice.
Yeah, and Falun Gong is one of the biggest taboo in China now since 1999 when the persecution has been launched. So all those so-called politically sensitive topics should not be touched by the Confucius Institute. If they are chased by students for an answer for those topics, and then the CI instructors should state the party line. That's what Sonia told me. She personally felt that.
To what extent do you think, based on your research, that it's not just soft power, that there may actually be something more sinister behind these institutions and the penetration that they're achieving in Western societies, kind of a hard power problem of counterintelligence, for example, recruiting running, perhaps even, operations against the West?
Yes, I do so, particularly because I'm in Canada, and Canada's spy agency, the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service, has been closely watched the development of Confucius Institute in Canada. As early as 2005, I believe, they have found, they mean the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service, we call it CSIS. CSIS is found. The Confucius Institute has been used by the Chinese government as the main soft power weapon or tools after the 2008 Beijing Olympic as a soft power to win the hearts and minds of Western societies. And they even in later years, I believe in 2012 or 13, CSIS put into their annual report one whole chapter about Confucius Institute raised quite a few concerns about the CI. One of it is CI spy or espionage activities in the hosting universities and countries.
I'm afraid we are hard out of time, Doris. This is a subject that I'd love to get into at greater length with you. I appreciate so much your sharing with us insights you've achieved through your film In the Name of Confucius. Could you tell us very quickly how people can see your film?
Right now, people can access Vimeo video on demand. And in future, we will be releasing the film on other digital platform and hopefully the TV broadcasters.
Terrific. So look for it on demand, folks. Doris Liu, thank you so much for joining us and for your important work on Confucius Institutes. Come back to us again soon, if you would. We're very concerned about these operations. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.